There you go. Now, another day, another talk. Story of my life again. Today is the final day of this retreat. It's going extremely quickly, as retreats always do. It won't be a short time before I'm sitting here starting the next retreat, whenever that will be, wherever that will be. But on this retreat, I'd like to spend this last talk just bringing it all together and just to show exactly what's going on, why I taught the way I did, and how it can be useful for you when you leave here. You can see that all the talks which I've been giving here on the last 9 days very much focused on not really what to believe or on any theories, but actually how you can use these teachings to develop your meditation. And obviously you'll be able to find out what this thing meditation really means by the experiences which you've had. This meditation is like developing that calm state of mind, but it's also a calm state of mind which always has a lot of happiness. Not dullness, not trance, not something boring, but going to a great sense of beauty inside the mind. And that whole path, that whole training, is not just the path which a Buddha taught to enlightenment, but also reveals along the way many truths, many insights about about life in general. And if I didn't ask you to sort of go so deep in your meditation, if I said stop and start reflecting on things too early, you've never gone as deep as you have achieved. When a coach asks a lot of their students, then those students tend to rise to the occasion. And sure enough, I mean, the coach sometimes never expects their students to complete all of the tasks, but by making it a very high goal, jhanas, enlightenment, I'm sure it's stretched you. You've got something a bit deeper to aspire towards. And by encouraging that aspiration, by putting it in your minds that those things are there for the taking, you have actually got much deeper. I've noticed in my mind that sometimes if you haven't got a goal, then you tend to be very lazy. But if you have a goal, you know, somebody says, oh, you can't do that, that's impossible, Ajahn Brahm, you're not supposed to be able to do that. And for my mind, it says, yeah, says who? And then I get into some nice meditation just to prove a point. Or if you hear someone else has had a nice meditation, and you think, hey, you know, someone's had a really good meditation, they haven't been meditating as long as I have. I've been in the Buddhist society much longer than they have. And that really gets you motivated, and you're more alert, you actually put more effort into the right places. So setting actually a goal actually does help you get deeper. However, at this stage of the retreat, you have to mention that goal there, one of its main purposes is not to be reached, but to stretch you, to get deeper into these deep meditations and into insight. That goal there is actually to unearth attachments, unearth wrong ways of thinking, and unearth the techniques to overcome those types of thinking. So during this retreat, you know, hopefully you've got the message that happiness is important, but also non-control is important. The whole last 9 days is very much centered on just letting things happen, on trying to take away all the decisions which you usually have to make on what you eat, when you eat, where you go, what you say, so you have no decisions to make. And you let go, and you just relax. And you find often that when you let go, when you relax, when you don't do anything, things become peaceful all by themselves. There's a certain amount of happiness comes without peace. Sometimes immense happiness comes without peace. And you get some inklings of religious experiences, remembering early times in your childhood or past lives, getting blissed out and things like that. Not only are you touching on some deep religious truths, but also you're finding out very important ways of living your life back in the world. One of the stories which again moved me when I first heard it, in which I take as standard for my own life as a monk, as a teacher, in which I encourage other people also to consider and put into practice, was a story which was told to me by a fellow school teacher when I was teaching maths and physics at a high school in Devon. And this fellow had been in the British Army during the Second World War, and he'd been fighting in Burma. And he told me one day that he'd been wandering with a small patrol of soldiers in the jungle somewhere, and one of the scouts came back with the terrible news that they'd stumbled into a whole battalion or a huge number of Japanese soldiers, and they were completely surrounded and there was no way out. And of course this young man, who was only a young man at the time, a young soldier, was very scared. He thought this was it. His number was up, he's going to die. Such a small number of soldiers, British soldiers, surrounded, vastly outnumbered by the Japanese, he thought there's no way they're going to survive this. But his second thought was, well, at least we can try and fight our way out, and we can at least take some of the enemy with us, which is the usual, you know, patriotic, macho, male sort of response to such things. But he was very surprised when his commanding officer, who was I think a major or something, said, no, we're not going to fight, so we're going to sit down, we're going to have a cup of tea. Because it was a British Army after all. So this young soldier sort of thought his commanding officer was absolutely crazy. Maybe, you know, the heat in the jungle had got to him and he couldn't think straight. I mean, how can you really think of a cup of tea when you're at war, in the jungles, surrounded by the enemy, and you may not even live for another 5 or 10 minutes? But in the army, orders are orders. So even though he thought it was absolutely imbecilic, all the soldiers together started making a cup of tea. And they're sitting there in the jungle, at war, surrounded by the enemy, drinking their cup of tea. And while this was happening, the scout went to check, came running back, saying, put everything away quickly. The enemy has moved. If we're quick, we can escape. This is what they did. That's why he could tell the story. And he says that he owes his life, not once, but many times, to that major and his wisdom. Because the metaphor, the simile there, was so obvious to him. Because many times in life, it's like you're surrounded by the enemy, and there is no way out. There's nothing to do. Every opportunity, every avenue, every road seems to be disaster. So what do most people do in such situations? They try and fight their way out. Maybe I can take other people with me, but I'm going to die, I know this. And that is the wrong response. As I've mentioned already, the response of a wise person is when there's nothing to do, do nothing. And what that meant for that young British soldier, when there's nothing to do, sit down and have a cup of tea. Enjoy the moment. The same way that man who was running through the jungle and jumped into the well, and there was a tiger above him, a snake below him, there's nothing he could do. So he just enjoyed the honey which happened to drip down. How sweet. Because what is happening there, when you're not struggling and doing things which is nothing to achieve, nothing you can do, when you're struggling so much, you tire yourself out, you don't get any happiness, any peace, and when there is something to do, when the enemy has moved and there's a path to escape, you're so tired, you're so frantic, you're so all over the place, there's no way you can take those windows of opportunity to do something. And this, unfortunately, is what happens to many people in their lives. They get very sick and are about to die, they struggle, instead of having a cup of tea and enjoying the last moments. Something is going terribly wrong in your life or with your relationship with other people, and sometimes there's nothing you can do. So instead of doing nothing, you frantically search for something to do. Forgetting one of the most effective things is nothing. Because in that doing nothing, there's a resting, there's a relaxing, and there's also getting more perspective. So this is why, in this retreat, we've tried to teach you the art of doing nothing. Basically, the art of being able to sit down and just have a cup of tea and enjoy the moment. Even though this might be your last moment. Even though you don't know what you're going home to afterwards. Even though it might be turmoil, hell, who knows what's happened while you've been away. Doesn't matter, because now, now you enjoy this beautiful company. You can't do anything about it, can you? I can't do anything about the monastery down at Serpentine. I don't know what they've been doing down there. I've been away, maybe parties every night. Maybe. No, they're very, very, very good monks down there. But I can't do anything, because I can't do anything, so I don't worry about it. So I enjoy just, you know, meditating and teaching and having a good time. So I've often taught in Nottamara and Singapore, you know, the simile of the cup. The longer you hold it, the heavier it becomes. That's your life, that's your worries, that's your family, that's your children. Hold, hold, hold. Heavier, heavier, heavier. Stress, nervous breakdown, bodily breakdown, everything goes wrong. Because you're still holding this cup. And you've heard me say before, what should you do when this gets heavy? Correct. Now, do you have to put that cup down forever? Of course you don't. Just rest for... This is a scientific experiment. You can do this when you get home. Fill up this with a cup of coffee. Don't drink it yet, but tea or whatever. Hold it for about 10 minutes until your arm starts to ache. And then put it down for about 20 seconds. Count it on the clock. Then pick it up again and ask yourself, is it the same weight? It actually is physically, scientifically, the same weight, but it feels much lighter, which is the important point. Being able to put things down and then pick them up afterwards when you're rested is how you deal with life without getting stressed out. All stress and the physical and mental problems which come from them does not depend on how much we've got in our cup. This could be a bucket. As long as I know that when it's heavy, I'll put it down and rest. When I'm rested, then I can pick it up and carry again. That way I can carry a much heavier bucket in my life, and also I can carry it much further. It makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? It's so easy to do. We can see what the problems are. Have any problem, think, never know how to put it down, and that's why we go crazy. Also, because we're holding all the time, we can never really get perspective on it. So I'm teaching how to let go of burdens. And if you want to be a monk or a nun, you can actually take this cup and just throw it in the bin. You don't even pick it up again ever. However, a lot of you don't want to do that, but at least you can know how to put it down for a while. So this training which you've been doing in your meditation is how to put down the cup. How to let go, how to let it down, let it away. And it's not easy, is it? Because even present moment awareness. How many of these moments of this retreat were you really here? Here. How much are we thinking about the dinner, or thinking about your family, or thinking about this dream, or that fantasy, or this, whatever it was you were doing? It's hard to put it down, isn't it? And sometimes a thought comes into your mind, some problem about your family in the past. And I said from the very beginning, that's not your family, that's not your sister, that's not your husband, that's not your child, not mine, these are just beings which come to visit us for a few years and then they go away again. But why is it that that's in the past, that's not ours, but we keep picking it up? It means that we don't get the full benefit of rest. But we try, we find the means of actually letting go of our burdens for the time of this retreat. 9 days, if you really put down your cup, for 9 days you've had no husband, no wife, you've had no kids, you've had no sisters, no brothers, no dogs, no cats, you've had no business, no work, no telephones, you have no debts, no money, you have no problems, no, if you put down your body, no physical problems, no diseases, you've got no gender, no girl, no boy, no this country, that country, you put everything down, if you really know how to put things down. Wouldn't that be wonderful? To be able to do that for 9 days. You came close. Many who did it for many minutes, sometimes many hours. How peaceful was that? It was lovely, wasn't it? Just to be able to have no burdens for a few days. What's the result of that? Is that really being irresponsible? Are you being someone who's just copping out and not doing their job and their duties in the world? Or is it the case you put that down for a few minutes, in this case 9 days, and then you can go on for the rest of the 11 months and 22 days of the year, you can carry your burden, it's so lighter, so much more light. Hopefully that's the case. And also it actually learn how to do that. Just let go. It means that in all sorts of other times in your life, when there is nothing to do, you can take the opportunity, the privilege to do nothing. That's why whenever you're going to work in your car and you come across the red traffic lights and you're stuck, always remember the story of the little novice. Stop. Because those red traffic lights are always teaching you Dhamma. Always reminding you, look, you can't go anywhere, you can't do anything. You can't sort of, you know, by worrying, make that traffic light go greener more soon. Just stop. I was actually, I tried to look when I was in Delhi, because I heard, and I couldn't actually see when I was in Delhi recently, but I heard, it's a good enough story to be true, that in the town of Delhi in India, instead of on their red traffic lights having the letters STOP, which is what we have here, what we have in Singapore, they've got the letters RELAX. Relax. Now, wouldn't that be a wonderful thing to have in the great cities of the world? In the red traffic lights, these big letters emblazoned by the red. Relax. Because when you're stuck in a traffic jam or traffic lights, you can't do anything, can you? So isn't this a wonderful opportunity just to relax, to take a few minutes off so you can just be at peace, to meditate? Because people rush so hard to get to work and they're stressed out trying to do things. Now you have this marvellous opportunity, you're in a traffic jam, you can just be there and be at peace. You've put down all the burdens of driving and going anywhere. You've stopped. So these are giving us ideas, Dhamma teachings, but because a lot of time we don't see them. So often in life it's like red traffic lights, we get stopped, we can't do anything, just we're waiting. It's, I mentioned that play, Waiting for Godot. In Buddhism it's waiting for Maitreya. Always waiting for this and waiting for that. Don't wait for anything, just stop and be where you are. So when we can actually do this, we find how to find moments in our life to put down our cup, to relax, to be peaceful. No matter how busy you think you are, no matter how important your job, there's always moments which are given to you in life as opportunities to stop, to rest and relax. And how many of those moments do we just ignore and throw away? So part of this retreat is giving you the courage and the confidence to take hold of those moments of peace and make the full use of them. When there's nothing to do, please, for the sake of your own mental health and physical health, and for the sake of the people you live with, for everyone's sake, for the sake of the happiness of all human beings, when there's nothing to do, please take the opportunity and do nothing. And be at peace. Not only will that make your life and your career and your ability to work, make it all improve, it'll also make your relationships at home improve, and you become a much calmer, more sensible person in this world. So it gives you the opportunity of resting. But also, what we're taught here today also gives you the opportunity of actually doing something. Because what I said this morning, that teaching, some of you weren't here to hear it. It was one of Ajahn Chah's teachings, which wasn't in any book, because the person who was told to was a young Australian boy who didn't tell anyone else, but told me when he came to visit Perth maybe 6 or 7 years ago. He had gone to see Ajahn Chah in the northeast of Thailand to ask some questions on the Dhamma, on meditation Buddhism. He heard Ajahn Chah was a very famous monk, very wise, and he wanted to ask these questions. He went all the way. Now those of you who have been there sort of know sort of how far away from Bangkok it is. Got to go all the way to Bangkok, from Bangkok in those days, not by the aeroplane, which is very quick, by the train all night. And then from the train terminal, catch a taxi or a bus to where Ajahn Chah lives, out in the sticks. We finally got there, and he finally asked, you know, where's Ajahn Chah, is he in? He was lucky because Ajahn Chah was in the monastery that day. He went to the hut, and he saw that Ajahn Chah was right there, surrounded by maybe 100, 150 people, all wanting attention, all wanting to ask their questions. So he sort of sat on the outside, waited and waited and waited. There's too many people, he couldn't even put his hand up or interrupt, he was too far away. And he's really quite despondent, he said, because he went all that way and he didn't have time to wait any longer to ask the questions. You know, so obviously he'd wasted his time in a long journey. And so he started walking away back to the entrance of the monastery to get in his taxi to go back to the station and go back to Bangkok. When sort of, you know, he looked at his watch and thought, the taxi's not coming for another half an hour or now. And so he wondered what he can do to kill some time. He saw the monks were sweeping the grounds. And there was a spare broom around, so he thought, well, you know, what if he was really into making merit or something, but he decided he might as well do something useful, so he picked up a broom and started sweeping. And as he was sweeping, 5 or 10 minutes had gone by, and he was, you know, just thinking and whatever, and he felt a hand on his shoulder. And he turned around, it was Ajahn Chah. Ajahn Chah, this incredibly compassionate monk, had seen this Westerner come here, and obviously seen that he was very disappointed and have time to ask any questions. And Ajahn Chah had finished sort of talking in his hut and was actually going to another appointment. And on Ajahn Chah's way to the car, he decided to just pass by this Westerner and give him some teachings. He didn't have much time, but the teachings which he gave this young man, the young man said, they were so deep and profound. So he thanks Ajahn Chah because he's used them time and time again in his life, and they're just so wonderful. Because all Ajahn Chah said, you know, through the interpreter, said to this young man, if you're going to sweep, give it everything you've got. And then Ajahn Chah turned around and went away. And that man sort of understood the deeper meaning. It doesn't mean just sweeping. I mean, whatever you do in your life, give it everything you've got. So if you're working, if you're talking on the phone, really listen to what that person is saying. Give it everything you've got. Don't just try and get rid of them so you can get to the next person. Hopefully that's, you've picked that up when you've been in the interviews. When I've been sitting there, even if I'm tired or I'm not really interested in what you're trying to say, I just push that aside. And I am interested. I try and listen to you and give the best advice as I possibly can. I really do give it everything I've got. And whatever you're doing in life, give it everything you've got. When I shave my, have a haircut, I give it everything I've got. That's also when, you know, you give donations. Give it everything you've got. Those are just jokes. So whatever you do, and you give everything you've got, you know, you actually find you're very successful. Because you give energy into what you don't do is anything half-hearted. And that includes taking time off and being peaceful. When it's time to take time off and be peaceful, you give it everything you've got. In other words, it's peaceful, like that's it, I'm going to be at peace. and you put full attention, full wisdom, full skill in being peaceful. So when you meditate, the old Zen say, you just meditate. When I'm giving a talk, I give a talk. When I'm meditating, I don't think what I'm going to talk about. When I'm having breakfast, I don't think what I'm going to do next. Just have breakfast. I give breakfast everything you've got. Because when you only eat one or two times a day in the morning, you've got to give it everything you've got, because if you don't, so you soon miss it, and that's it, you're finished. So you give everything you've got. Now that sort of teaching actually brings up a lot of energy in life. Because when you first think about a teaching such as that, you think, well, if I give everything I've got to, you know, like giving this talk, I'll have no energy left for when the interviews come. If I give everything to the interviews, I'll have no energy left when the meditation comes. When I give everything to my meditation, I won't have any energy left for the next thing I'm going to do. But energy doesn't work that way. Mental energy, the more you encourage, the more you arouse, the more you have. So this thing of putting mindfulness into what you're doing, putting everything you've got into this moment, really giving it full attention, not only brings up energy, not only sort of brings up a lot of success in whatever you're doing, it's not only sort of practicing mindfulness in daily life, but it also shows you just how to balance your life, because when there's many times to rest, you give rest everything you've got. That makes life far more richer. Whether you're a monk, whether you're a nun, whether you're a husband, whether you're a wife, whether you're a mother, whether you're a boss, whether you're a worker, you give that everything you've got. You're really responsible. That's your duty. I'm going to do it. So that actually is putting effort into one's life. It is putting energy into one's life. When you put effort and energy into your life, you find the next thing which comes afterwards is happiness. Because happiness is like mental energy. And depression is just mental sluggishness. Sloth and torpor, and you've experienced a bit of sloth and torpor, especially in the mornings or late at night, and it's really unpleasant. There's no happiness there at all. The energy, you get this wonderful bubbliness and brightness. And once you have that energy, bubbliness and brightness, that's when it gets easy to do this perception of the beautiful which I've been talking about. An energetic mind can see just the flowers and the trees and the little birdies and such beautiful things. But when you're sloth and torpor, these stupid birds waking me up, shitting all over the place. Sort of, you know, I don't know what they're up to. We're supposed to be on 8 precepts there, but I bet many of those birds aren't on 8 precepts. Look at them. whatever it is, it's very easy when you're in a sluggish, depressed mood to even look at the flowers. They're just really stupid flowers. They give me hay fever, you know, these flowers. I happen to be right next to them, these stupid flowers. I hate flowers. They look so beautiful, they're pansies, these flowers, they're just only for namby-pamby monks. We shouldn't have flowers on your... What sort of thing do I think we are? So it's very easy to get into a depressive mood. The most beautiful thing in the world you can actually put down. But in a happy mood, an energetic mood, the most ugliest thing in the world you can see beauty in. It shows you some of the tricks about happiness and suffering in the world. Whenever actually you see suffering in the world, or rather you suffer with it, you get angry at it, that you get upset with it and depressed with it. It's nothing to do with what's happening out there. It's what's going on inside you. It's not the problem of the world, it's the problem inside of you. That's why when you start to develop that perception of the beautiful and have the energy to actually to do that practice, you find that all of those things you thought were problems and difficulties in life, you can handle very easily. And I'm very impressed at many stories of meditators who deal with the most terrible experiences of life in such a wonderful, inspiring way. Especially when people die. It's one of the disciples here some years ago. She always had a trouble with her lungs, and when she went to the hospital to have it checked up, she rang me that evening and the doctors had given her the results. She had got a very bad lung cancer, too far advanced, nothing really you can do. So she's going to die. And of course, no one knew, but 2 months, 3 months, 4 months, somewhere around that time, you know, this time next year, you probably won't be alive. It was true, and she lasted about 4 or 5 months, that's all. But when I went to see her afterwards, she was in the bed there laughing and joking, and just completely at ease with what's going on. And now she was talking about her death, and she was cracking jokes, because she was a Thai lady, and said, look, don't tell all the Thai ladies, come and see me. So if they really want to see me, please ask them to wait a while. When I'm in my coffin, they can see me as much as they like. And so, ha ha, she started joking. Because, you know, there's sort of people talk so much, and sometimes it gets a bit tiring when you're not feeling so well. And of course, what do most people do when you go and visit someone who's sick? Say, how are you feeling? What a stupid question that is. They wouldn't be in hospital if they were feeling well, would they? And also, it puts a pressure on that person, you know, because you come all this way to see them, express your love, and you can think, I'm feeling really awful. You know, you feel really guilty. So many people, when they get visited by their friends and their loved ones in hospitals, they lie. They say, I'm feeling a little bit better today, when they're really actually feeling much worse. And they say that just to cheer up and please the visitors, when it really should be the visitors trying to please and cheer up the ones to see. So this lady said, no, I don't want any visitors, or just a few visitors. And because of that, just after I visited and you know, laughed and they're not going to die, okay. So I'll do your funeral, yeah, that's really good. And when I was going out, sort of there was like the senior nurse, the sister of the ward, sort of came up to me and said, oh look, I'm really, really glad you've come. See, because that girl, she's in denial. What do you mean she's in denial? I said. And this was like, she was an Irish nurse, obviously like a Catholic. And I was asking her, so what do you mean she's in denial? She said, look, she's going to die. She's just been told just a few hours ago she's going to die. And no, she's not angry. She's not upset. She's not miserable. She's laughing. She's having fun. She's obviously in denial. And I had to tell this, it was really good fun actually talking. I said, look, I've just been in there for about an hour and she's been talking about death, 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 I'm going to die. She's not denying it at all. She's right in the front of her mind. She knows what's going to happen. She's accepted it. She's at peace with it. And she's cracking jokes about it. I said, that's a good Buddhist. And that worried her because she'd never seen that done before. That's why, you know, she assumed it must be denial. If you've just been told you're going to die, and you're not miserable and upset and angry and depressed, there's something wrong with you. That's our world, isn't it? And someone you're about to say, oh, I'm really sorry to hear that. And what do you mean you're sorry to hear that? It's part of life, that's all. So that was a person that actually practiced some Dharma, understood some Dharma, and so she gave it everything she got to die well, not to get better, but to die. And she died really well. And I was just really proud of that lady, just how well she died. So this is sort of how we put everything we've got into what we're doing, and how that we can actually accept these things, and how it just solves a lot of problems in life. Because our wisdom shows that we are going to die. What do you expect? That was actually one of Ajahn Chah's favourite sayings. People come up to him and say, oh, I'm really having a hard time. I just found out my husband's got a mistress. My children are on drugs. Sort of money we had has all been sort of lost because my husband's also been gambling. And there's no money left. We're in big debt. And they're just really crying in front of Ajahn Chah, and it's the end of the world. And they just say, well, what do you expect? What do you mean, what do you expect? Because you expect your husband always to be absolutely faithful and your wife always to, you know, be very nice and pretty and do the right things, and your children. What do you expect of your children? To be doctors and to be engineers and to be successful and always to be happy and to live a long life. You never expect them to die. You never expect things to go wrong. I mean, what do you expect, really? what you expect is just some fantasy which never happens in the world. So when you understand like some of the teachings we've been giving here, what do you actually expect from your meditation? Do you really expect to be able to sit down here after 9 days and be able to get into jhana every time? What do you really expect? Come on. Sometimes we expect that. Or, no, something's wrong here. The food isn't good. Or Ajahn Brahm is not teaching properly enough. I'm going to go to another teacher next time. Or, the cushion's not quite right. There's something wrong here. But what do you expect? So that's the wonderful thing. Joy at last, and there's no happiness in the world. So when you expect nothing, you then expect this perfection. Then, of course, you're at peace. How often in your work to expect perfection of yourself and the people you work with? How much do you expect perfection from your husband, your wife and your kids? Isn't that the problem we have with a lot of suffering in our life? I expected you to do much better than this, kid. You didn't come top of the class. When I was a teacher, I had enough innate wisdom that one of the kids who came bottom in the class in maths I was teaching, I felt very sorry for the poor boy, because he came bottom, and you could see the expression on his face, he was really disappointed. I went up to him and said, look, so you came bottom of the class, someone's got to come bottom, so really it's quite a compassionate thing you've done for the rest of the students to take that position. If he'd been a Buddha, I said, that's a real bodhisattva to come bottom. So everyone else could come better than you. But as soon as I started talking like that, it didn't feel so bad anymore. But it's true that someone has got to come bottom of the class. So why do you get depressed about it? So what you're doing is that bringing your expectations in line to what life could offer you. So what do you expect out of life in the future? Be careful not to have expectations which life cannot fulfill. If your expectations are humble and realistic, you can put all your effort into doing that. If it doesn't work, well, I gave it my best. At the end of the day, before you go to sleep, I give everything I've got, I can be happy and satisfied, even if it hasn't worked. Now that was my attitude with Ajahn Chakra. We started building this monastery. Give everything we've got, but if it doesn't work, because many obstacles are very easy not to work, and who cares? When Ajahn Jacko left and I got lumbered with being the senior monk, it wasn't by design at all, it just happened. I looked back and I thought to myself, I said, well, I'll give it a go. But if like people don't like me, I'll give terrible talks, they really get upset at all my silly jokes. And then it doesn't matter if I'm not cut out to be a teacher, that's even better, because I can spend all the time by myself, being quiet. So I thought to myself, I'll give it a go. If it works, that'll be great, because I'll be happy serving others. But if it doesn't work, that'll be great also, because I can just be peaceful, be like a silent Buddha. So it was great when you have those sort of, don't expect anything. Give everything you've got, whatever happens, you're happy. So if you ever got a sickness, I tell you, you either get better or you die. So either way, you're happy. Instead of getting miserable. So, you work, you give everything you've got. If you succeed and are good at your profession, it's great. If you fail, then it doesn't matter, you can always go do something else. If you have a relationship with someone else, with a nice girl, and you go out with her and you give everything you've got, but it doesn't work, it's great. You become a monk. And if it does work out, you can have a nice, happy married life, whatever it is. So, whatever way, that positive attitude, you can always make something out of it. So this is actually what you expect out of life. And those expectations, you can see their danger, and you can see how to use them. And you've been doing that while you've been meditating. When you meditate, if you expect, when you start meditating, right, this is it, I'm going to get jhana now. So, is that being realistic? What happens? You just make yourself all upset, and you make yourself all stressed, and you get disappointed. But instead of expecting sort of jhanas or enlightenment is sitting, if you just say, I'm just going to be peaceful, then what happens? If you don't expect anything, then everything comes to you. This is actually the way. So this is marvelous when you can actually put some of these trainings which you're doing here into practice in your daily life. All that you've learned here, if you really want to succeed in some task, you've got to put all the attentions into the details, the path. So if I want to build a new toilet block, which we're doing now at our monastery, I just have to put my attention into this brick we're laying now. One step at a time. One moment, one breath at a time. One moment at a time. The old present moment awareness. People in business can only do that present moment awareness. They do a plan, but come back to the present moment so they can achieve that plan. When you have a goal, always remember the route. Otherwise you get lost. That way you succeed. So I've been reading in newspapers that all these monks and Tibetan teachers, Theravada teachers, always teaching these CEOs in business now. Not only is you get like in Buddhist psychotherapy, but now you also got Buddhist business now. Now Buddhist principles going into sort of business because it works. It's very successful. So this is actually how you can take all that you've learned here on this retreat and use it in your daily life. And there will come a time when problems arise in your daily life. No huge difficulties. It might be relationship difficulties, it might be monetary difficulties, it might be change of lifestyle difficulties. And what do? You know that this thing which we said about the gatekeeper? You tell the gatekeeper, I've got a problem. Describe the gatekeeper what the problem is and forget about it. When you start to trust this gatekeeper is an amazing person. And you give that problem to the gatekeeper and you stop worrying about it, you stop thinking about it, you let it go. As if it churns around in the mind somewhere, then afterwards the answer comes out. You understand what you're supposed to do. But if you're really close to the problem all the time, all the time, all the time, you can never see what needs to be done. As I say, all wisdom comes from silence. I gave the simile, which is one of my favourite similes, of what's a cup. This is a problem. Now what is this? What's really going on? What's deeply going on? You've got to hold that in front of you, put that in the mind as it were, and then shut up. And let all the old labels disappear until you can actually see what this truly is. When you've got a problem, what's going on? You keep thinking, 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 thinking. You never get anywhere. You're just calling this cup, gold, 6 inches, 3 inches, round, this way. It's not really seeing deeply into anything. So, if you have a problem in life, sort of acknowledge it. Don't deny it, obviously. Make sure you know all its details. It's like programming the computer. Put it all in. And allow this natural program of your mind, that the investigation, just to, in silence, to see what truly is going on. And of course Ajahn Chah would be great about that. He'd always, you know, get the right problem. There was, when he first went to England, some of these English Buddhists started coming to see him. And this lady came, and she was a very knowledgeable Buddhist. And she had read much of Buddhism, especially Abhidhamma. So she came and asked Ajahn Chah. Ajahn Sumedho had to be the interpreter. And she said that there's something like 17 mind moments. She's only managed to, this is every moment, 17 parts of like one movement of mind. She's only managed to see about 8 or 9 of them so far. How can he help us see the other 8? And Ajahn Sumedho translated it to this woman. Ajahn Chah said something back. Ajahn Sumedho asked back, I can't tell her that. And Ajahn Chah said, you have to, I've said it. And Ajahn Chah left the room. And Lord Ajahn Sumedho had to translate Ajahn Chah's answer. And he said, but madam, he said, Ajahn Chah said that you're like a person who raises chickens and doesn't collect the eggs, only collects the chicken shit. Lord Ajahn Sumedho. He had to say, she stormed out of the room, but she didn't come back again. But that's in silence. I mean, Ajahn Chah, even though I heard that lady, it really told her exactly what was going on. she was being a Buddhist, but she wasn't actually getting the eggs, you know, the fruit of this path. She was just getting the dung. So that's really down to earth. Ajahn Chah wouldn't mince words that way. And that's why he was such a great teacher. And yeah, he would really put you on the line. One of my great experiences with Ajahn Chah, and this was not just worldly things, he was trying to get me really sort of deeper into my understanding. This was a time when he used to come to our monastery in Thailand once every week when he was starting to get a bit sick, before he came too sick. Because the Western monks, we really had this amazing idea that Ajahn Chah was getting a bit sick, and we always like to have a great teacher around as much as possibly can. So we built a sauna in this monastery. And it was actually just for Ajahn Chah. Once we built it, we said, Ajahn Chah, we've got this wonderful sauna, why didn't you come and use it? And it was the only monastery in that part of Thailand which had a sauna. And it's supposed to be good for your health. And of course, I won't go to the sauna with him to look after him, I'll just go around the back of the hall to meditate. And it's really lovely meditation, because I was so inspired by his talk. And after I came out of the meditation, maybe 45 minutes, maybe an hour, I came out and thought, oh, I better go and see if I can look after Ajahn Chah. Maybe he's still in the sauna, maybe I can hang his towel up or do something. And so I went walking towards the sauna. And he'd already finished his sauna, and he was actually walking back again. So we crossed each other on the path. And he was with about three or four, actually, laymen, Thai people, who'd also brought him to the monastery. And he obviously looked me straight in the eye, like some of these teachers can do. And he obviously saw very quickly that I had a nice meditation and my mind was pretty clear. So he looked at me very deep and said, Brahma Wangsa. This was like translating into English, Brahma Wangsa. Why? And of course, even though my mind was clear, it wasn't clear enough, so I don't know. I said, and he laughed and he said, look, if anyone ever asks you that question again, the answer to why is there is nothing. And he said, you understand? I said, yes, I understand. He said, no, you don't. But it was really good because, you know, that was a really deep teaching. So I was tempted to do that when we had all these questions. Every question, you know, why this, why that? There is nothing. Next question, there is nothing. Next question, there is nothing. Next question, there is nothing. Because that was like the power of like a great teacher like that. He would not just answer the question, but like go right underneath from where that question was coming from. Not just what the question was, but why you asked that question in the first place. So there's the power of like a great teacher. And where did such wisdom come from? That was a fellow who'd only got 4 years of education, primary school, not even finished like the 6 or 7 years of primary school we have in most modern countries. Just 4 years of schooling, that's all. But that was one wise monk. And where did that wisdom come from? Not from thinking. You can't get to such great wisdom through thinking, through silence. And it wasn't just wisdom as far as Dharma was concerned and Buddhism, the way he ran his monastery. He was the only monk who he saw these Western monks coming, and he didn't just train them as meditators or train them as good Buddhist monks. He had this great idea. He had about 6 or 7 monks there, and there was a forest close by. He said to them, okay, you go start a monastery over there. And Ajahn Sumedho, he was a senior monk, and he never ran a monastery before. Ajahn Chah knew that one day these Western monks would go off to their own countries. He wanted not just to teach them how to meditate, not just to teach them Dharma, but teach them how to be teachers. Here's a monastery, look after it. A great wisdom. He was actually the only Thai monk who actually did that. He didn't just teach monks, he taught teachers. And you know, it's hard work, you make all sorts of mistakes, get into all sorts of mischief and trouble. And the lay people go and complain to Ajahn Chah, and say, "Oh, just the Westerns, don't worry about it." And little by little you learn, you know, what to do, how to sort of run monasteries. That's right, you know, it's great wisdom. And so it wasn't just in Dharma wisdom, it was in worldly wisdom. This fellow was really great. He was also the one, this is Ajahn Chah's story, it's now getting on my mind. He was the one, I was here at this time, one of Ajahn Chah's stories, where first year, I thought, yeah, it was the first year I was a monk there. And he was going to some ceremony in town, and so it was about 4 monks were going with him. He was in the front seat, the passenger seat, next to the driver, and there's his 3 Western monks in the back. I was one, and there's this like novice monk, American Gary, and there was Ajahn Babakra, who's, you know, translator. He'd been a monk for 3 or 4 years, a really great Thai he had. And so, halfway in the journey, we were looking out the window, Ajahn Chah turned around at this American novice and said, "You're thinking about your girlfriend, aren't you?" And he said that through the translator. And this poor American novice, he just... Because his jaw dropped, he was. Ajahn Chah read his mind. You know, he was first of all like shocked and a bit scared at, you know, this monk's power. And then Ajahn Chah smiled, because if, you know, if he hit you, he'd always smile afterwards to, you know, realize that, you know, he's still your friend. And he said, "Look, we can help you there." He said, "It's a very good technique to help you here." He said, "When you next write to your girlfriend, ask her to send something of hers, something very personal. Mm-hmm. So whatever you're thinking of her, you can always look at that and you've got something to remember." And so this young novice said, "Is that allowable?" You know, because, you know, it was, a, you know, like if you've got a girlfriend, you get a locket of her hair, or sort of, you know, a picture of her, or something to remind you of her. Then, "Is that allowable?" And I just said, "Oh, yes, allowable, yes, allowable." And he said to this Ajahn Babakra, he said some more. This Ajahn Babakra just creased himself laughing. Tears were coming down his face. And, you know, this Gary and myself, you know, what has Ajahn Chah said? Because we can understand the Thai that well. What he said, when Ajahn Babakra sort of got himself together, he said, "It's allowable, but Ajahn Chah told you to do this. Next time you write to your girlfriend, send her a little bottle and ask her to put in there some of her feces and send that back to you. And whenever you start thinking about your girlfriend, oh, it's so wonderful, open up the little bottle." "Don't you actually say, 'I love everything about you, my dear'?" That's why he laughed so much. Ajahn Chah was not only a joke, but it was true. There's something about, you know, when you think of your girlfriend or your boyfriend, you know, you love everything about you, but really, do you really love everything? So this was actually wisdom, which came very deep. It was funny, was encouraging, inspiring, but it was true. And sometimes you wonder, where did all that wisdom come from? Some of those stories you can actually see in the Buddha's suttas. Some of those stories are absolutely originals. You know, some of the stories I say are original. No one, you know, don't get that from Ajahn Chah, or get it from Ajahn Chah or other monks, but some are original Ajahn Brahms. Where does wisdom come from? In worldly life, or in Dharma life? It all comes from that silence. Just being still. So if you have any problems in life, difficulties in life, don't just go thinking about it. Always remember what you've done here. You come across a problem in meditation, what is that? Stand back and see what particular hindrance or obstacle it truly is. There's always some degree of grasping there, or some degree of wanting or craving or controlling. That's the problem. See what it is, and you can let go. And from stillness comes wisdom. And from the wisdom comes the stillness. Because once that problem's finished, all that worrying, all that problem, that suffering's all gone. So that's why Ajahn Chah, the Buddha, would always say, wisdom and stillness, they always go together. They run around each other. So whenever you're wise, you'll be peaceful. When you're peaceful, you'll be wise. It's just getting into that little cycle. More peace, more wisdom, more wisdom, more peace. And you'll find that your life, whether it's on the meditation cushion, or in the workplace, or at home, the more still and peaceful you can become, the more you practice this path of meditation, the stillness, the calmness, taking time out, stopping every now and again, time to work, give everything you've got, problem, stand back, what's going on, you'll find you become a much wiser, more effective person. Which brings me on to the last subject, because compassion is what we have to practice, you know, both in worldly life and on the cushion and in the monasteries. That's why I try to be so compassionate to you and say, if you really want to, you can sit on a chair and sleep in. Because in Buddhism, we're not into torturing people. So compassion is important, but sometimes we need to how to be compassionate wisely. We don't really know sort of how to give happiness to ourselves and others. And all the great intentions of the world, we really want to help, but when we mistake suffering for happiness and happiness for suffering, we think we're giving people happiness, but really we're just giving them more suffering. So that's why sometimes people come up to me, I've already mentioned this before, some monks have psychic powers, some monks can see lottery numbers, some monks can see what's going to happen in the next lotto, $30 million, $40 million. They come up to the monk and say, Ajahn Brahm, so now I'm really sort of struggling, sort of in my business, you know, my children, sort of, they really need a few more things. You know, I've looked after you for all these years, and surely you can give me one lottery number, just once, that's all. You know what they usually say, when they actually, a few people come up like this, and they say, and if we win, we'll give you 5%. Only 5%, I did all the work. I always say no. You know why I say no? Because if they won, it just gives them more suffering. Now, I don't want to have more money to worry about. So I'm compassionate. I want people to live simply, not to give them more burdens and more worries and more concerns and more things. So that's out of compassion of what you ought to be poor. So a lot of times, like, what we think is happiness is being wealthy. What we think of happiness is being powerful. What we think of happiness is being famous. It's the last thing you want for anyone, to be famous. I've already got it planned out what would happen if I could become ever famous. Because as a monk, I can change my name. I've got a few disciples who are surgeons. I'll give myself a face job, so you won't recognize me, and I'll be Ajahn somebody else. So like, all these things, is that's a great burden. So you don't want to give people burdens. So to be compassionate in this world, you know, to really serve and be helped, we have to know how to be compassionate. And sometimes, so even just coming to a retreat, spending 9 days in a place like this, is the most compassionate thing you can do to the people you live with. Not only you are out of their hair for 9 days, but also and then you go home and say, you're back already, dear. So also that when you come home, usually because you're rested, because you're relaxed, because you're at peace, you're a much nicer person to work with and to live with. So remember that people have to put up with you. It's not that you have to put up with others, people have to put up with you as well, you know. So if you make yourself nice and soft and peaceful, compassionate and wise, you're a much, much nicer person to live with and work with and put up with. So sometimes it's nice to meditate for the sake of other beings. So that's why that even in your office or your home, if people say, what are you meditating for? Is it just to escape? No, I'm meditating to make you happy, my dear. And that's true. Very often this happens. that people who come to the regular meditations, it happens quite regularly, and they come up to me afterwards and they say, I didn't feel like coming to meditation this evening, I just came from work and I was so tired and had a really busy day, and I thought, now I'm going to miss meditation this evening. But they said, I had to go because my kids said, Mum, you have to go. Go to your meditation. So I don't feel that. I said, Mum, go to your meditation because you're a much nicer mother when you come back. If you don't go to your meditation, you're just hopeless, you're just unbearable. Mother, go to the meditation. And so the mother gets sent by the kids. There's another story which happened some years ago during one of the weekend retreats. We always used to have these weekend meditation retreats. We still have about three a year I think now. And this one person, this man in Perth, always wanted to go to the meditation retreat. And his wife said no each time. He asked, can I go to the meditation retreat this weekend? Or, you know, a couple of weeks' time. She said, look, darling, sort of on the weekend, I've been working all week, on the weekend we've got all these jobs to do. You know, I've got to go to the shops, you know, you've got to mow the lawn, you've got to take the kids to sport, we've got to, you know, clean this and do that. It's just too busy on the weekend. No, you can't go. She said, oh, okay, darling, never mind. The next time there was a meditation retreat, he asked again, meditation retreat, can I go? He said, no, you can't go. We've got the shopping, the cleaning, the washing, the taking the kids here and doing all this. Of course you can't go. He was a very persistent man. So one day, after that, three or four, five, six times, he said again, darling, there's a meditation retreat this weekend. Can I go? And she would get so frustrated and said, okay, you go. Just you leave me with the washing, you leave me with the kids, you leave me with everything. You just go and be selfish. So he went. Well, she told him to go. But what happened next is a great story, because he told us to, Ajahn Chakra and myself, this afterwards. When he went, when he came home after the 2 days of retreat, I mean, she was just, you know, so worn out. But when he came home, he was such a nice husband, that she could see the change. He was much more compliant, more sensitive, more soft. And she was so impressed. And he told us this, no lie, no exaggeration. When it came to the next retreat, he didn't need to ask. She gave him the money and sent him off. Because you can see it works. So this is why, like, if you want to be compassionate to others, you want to know how to be compassionate. And one of the most wonderful ways of being compassionate is coming to the next retreat. So I hope to see you all then, and hopefully you'll be able to, when you go home, you'll be able to reflect that what you did here is not just for yourself, it's for other beings. And then you know about this Arahat Bodhisattva business. When you spend time for your own enlightenment, for your own peace, for your own calm, for your own happiness, that's the best thing you can do to all the people you come across and you live with. So becoming an Arahat is the same as a Bodhisattva path. Do you understand now? Okay. Any questions before we finish? I'm sure you've got a couple, and this is your last chance.
I was a bit confused about this book.
The book? Yeah, I think so. Yeah, we've got President of the Buddhist Society here. You can shout them a few copies. Okay, very good. Yes?
Can you ask a sentry
to help you let go of something? Can you ask a sentry
to help you let go of something you find difficult to let go?
Yeah, you can help them. Say, look, you know. But the thing is, with sentry, it's all about delegation. Because that's a beautiful way of letting go. So, you know, give the problem over to someone else. You know, you look after it. So, this is how we have to delegate. You have to have trust. And also you have to be prepared that the job isn't done as well as you think you can do it. A lot of the time we think we can do the job better, but that's basically pride and delusion. A lot of the time they can do it much better than us, but we don't want to admit that. But nevertheless, delegating it is a lovely way of letting go. So you're delegating the task of mindfulness to the gatekeeper. Letting go. But you can do that to delegate the gatekeeper. Say, gatekeeper, go and search out the best ways to let go. Just be quiet, and then wisdom will come up afterwards. And you should get a lot of insight into what letting go means and how to let go from this retreat. You've done some things, and it hasn't worked at all. You've got more and more tense. You know, you press other buttons, or turn other switches, and you get so peaceful. That's letting go. So it's many, many things here I've taught you about the art of letting go. And don't think that letting go is always just putting it down and never picking up again afterwards. You let go, but you'll be able to pick it up again afterwards, and so much easier. So thought, you can put thought down, leave it alone, be absolutely silent. When you pick it up again afterwards, the thought is much more easy to direct. That's actually one of the dangers in meditation, which I mentioned in the interviews, I didn't mention it publicly. When you get to a certain level of samadhi, so instead of the thought being just so hard to direct, you want to think about one thing and then it sort of veers off into something else and it goes in another direction. When you get a decent degree of peace in the mind, you can take a thought, a problem, and you can channel that thought so deeply, just keeping on the one thing. For people who live in the world have to sort of like do PhD degrees, or they have to finish a problem with their work, the ability actually to keep the problem in mind and stay long enough with it is a very powerful aspect of the mind. It's a danger sometimes because it gets to the point in meditation, your thought gets so good that it's all these problems you think you have, and you can waste a lot of time because you feel at last you've got the space, the direction, the energy to solve these problems. You go solving problems, which is great fun to do, but it's not the time to do it yet. But now the retreat's over, it's a great time to do that. So if you've got sort of a difficulty in life, you find you can actually sustain your thought. Your thought is much more directed. So you've got a problem like sort of, what am I going to do, say, for the next building in the nuns' monastery? And actually take that, put that in your mind, and you can actually keep it there long enough, and you can actually get really decent answers.
I'm thinking of back to social life. If you are one against majority, meaning that you are one in a mix of so many people, so won't you be classified as anti-social if you like to have your own, disquietude?
No, if you're one amongst many, it's just like one little light bulb which give light to so many hundreds of people. These two candles behind me, they've just been very lonely in here, but they've given light to all these many, many people in here. So, just you can give your light to so many people. It's not being antisocial, because you can see that, that I'm a monk, I'm very social. When it's time to be social, you're social. When it's time to be quiet, you're quiet.
Because lifestyle is different.
Well, I think you make your lifestyle. So, you have your little areas where you can be quiet. When you go out to your family, you can be with your family. When you go to work, be with your work. But the thing is that if you're in your home, you're not in the retreat. So in your home, be in your home. You can make your little room where you live your little retreat center. So when you're in that room, you're in retreat. When you're out there with your family, you're with your family. So if you're in your meditation, don't be with your family. If you're in your family, don't be with your room. Where you are, present moment awareness. It's always the case that, this time of the retreat, people want to be back home. As soon as they're back home, they want to be back in this retreat. Crazy. Yeah?
I just wanted to make a comment about the word that you wrote. I think it's kind of cultural connotation. I'll say, when I grew up in Sri Lanka, thinking and learning in Sri Lanka, and then when I really reflect back, and there was no equivalent term that we could really use about ordinary people. I'm sure that my compassion will hear me correctly if I'm saying something wrong or translation. And the only word I could really relate to was the appeasement or the renunciation. But then I really look at the monk who really gave me dharma, what were those or ways related. And when I relate about the renunciation or letting go, I have really learned from you. There was no renunciation as such. They had huge temples, they had fence cars, and we go to the library, there was huge artifacts and so on. So it was against the letting go, really. So the point I'm just making is that it had a cultural connotation. In one I was also saying the same thing last evening in past, really. So, in our mind case, really, so I have to unlearn you know, what have really got conditioned as a child and as an adult later on. So the point is that, you know, it's very important for us to unlearn what we have really got conditioned. Now, there are some language issues.
Good, yes. That's actually very true. That's why a few people have actually pointed out that they think maybe why Western monks and nuns are going to more to the heart of Buddhism before, because they haven't got anything to unlearn. Or the whole tradition, you know, which well, what Buddhism is supposed to be, they just don't know what Buddhism is supposed to be. So they're not like a burden with that. That's such a very good thing there, that you have to unlearn. And, but even so, again, there are many very great monks and nuns from Asian countries, some Thai monks, Burmese monks, Sri Lankan monks, you know, great, great wise and future teachers, future famous teachers. But they're always like the rebellious ones. You know, look at that tradition and what's useful, they keep. But they've got the guts, the courage to say, well, this isn't working, this isn't what we're supposed to be doing. Let's change it, let's stop it. But I know that sometimes people think that Theravada is the most traditional of like Buddhist teachings. But the type of Theravada which, you know, where I grew up, the forest traditions, that was always rebellious, always has been rebellious. In fact, if you look at the original suttas, the teachings of the Buddha were very rebellious. You know, because he was going against, you know, the teachings which were at the time very much of Brahmanism. He went completely against the caste system, which was actually really heretical at the time. He was a rebel. And with Ajahn Chah was a rebel as well, because I was there in Northeast Thailand when the monks in Bangkok sent up a delegation to check this monk out, find out what he was doing. One of the heretical things he was doing, you know, which really upset the monks in Bangkok, you know, he was living simply. He wasn't accepting money. And I had the great privilege actually to go into his room once, where he was living. And this was the last years of his teaching life. He's incredibly famous. All these generals and queen and princesses coming to see him. And even was a prime minister at the time, Peridasa, went to see Ajahn Chah. He was the president of Sri Lanka at the time. And had a very famous monk. I went up into his room. It was empty. He just had a mat and a pillow, his couple of robes on the line, and that was it. No books, no artifacts, there wasn't even a Buddha statue up there, if I remember correctly. Completely empty room. But that was actually a sign of a great, great monk. There were some monks in one monastery, you go into their huts, and you can't tell whether it's someone's living there or whether it's empty. Because I've got hardly anything there at all. And that really impresses me. And they can have lots and lots of things if they want to, but they decide not to. So it's a sign of, you know, a person who's really sort of knows what the tradition is all about. All of these buildings which we have, this is just supposed to be practical, like a dwelling for the night. And your bowl and robes are supposed to be the only possessions. So in the teachings of the suttas, like a monk or a nun, should be able to take the bowl and robes and go like a bird, just flying from place to place, carrying only the weight of their wings. That was that, how the Buddha put it. Just a bowl, one wing, their robes, the other wing. Just going. Do you get inspired by that degree of freedom? There's one very wonderful time in my monastic life when you go on this, what we call the tudong in Thai. It's like charaka in Sinhalese. Just go wandering. And the rules of these monasteries are, if you go wandering, you can't leave any possessions back in the monastery. You either take them with you or you give them away. So you start off with all this weight, all these things which are very, very important to you. And you have to walk. You're not going in a car, not going on a bus, just walk all day. And after a while, you sort of get rid of this and you get rid of that. And after a sort of 2 or 3 weeks, you look at all your possessions, all your worldly possessions, all you have in the world, and it's so light you can just skip along the roads. And that's all you have. And it's such a wonderful feeling of like going on, you're not tied to any monastery, you can go to this monastery, you can go left or you can go right. and no one is telling you which way to do it, and it doesn't matter which way you go. But everything you own is there on your back.
In fact, just to comment on that, I realized that when you're playing with him, you'll be from the monastery. And it's very bad, I hadn't thought. And I was really ashamed of myself, the whirlpools and so on.
Yeah.
But when I really put that 12 baggage, the 2 months baggage, I was really ashamed. And I thought, my God, if I could really travel lightly like this, this is what I'm going to do.
It's marvellous, but as a monk, I mean, you've sort of got many advantages, because every monastery in the world is like a hotel. We don't have, you've got this amazing club membership, we don't have to pay anything. I can roll up at any monastery and I can get looked after.
Well, you won't have much shaving and sex when you become a monk. But do most of your monks have gone to the retreat first, I guess, before they became monks?
No, there's monks come from other countries, some monks have come from here. Monks get inspired for all sorts of different reasons, but many of them, you know, go to retreats and they get advanced meditation, they get deep meditation. And if they're in the fortunate position where they've got no attachments and not too many duties, you know, they're not sort of attached to wives or to children, and then really encourage them, go for it while you can. Because remember my story, I was really fortunate because finished off one relationship and being a teacher that, you know, it's a job I can always go back to any time in those days. And there was always a shortage of, you know, science teachers, maths teachers as there are these days. And so, great, I can take a couple of years off and just go and look at my spiritual life. And if I hadn't done it then, you know, when I was only 23, 24, if I hadn't taken that, I'd have got caught up. For sure. You know, you get another relationship, you get married, you get someone pregnant, and goodness knows, and that's 18 years, 20 years of like prison and going to work. So, you know, it's a very, very close thing. I was very lucky. There's karma, obviously.
What's that, G plan?
Oh, your path, yeah. Yeah. So that's obviously it's meant to happen, but you can see just how dangerous it is and how easy it is to get caught up in the world. This world is very sticky. The longer you stay in it, the more sticky it gets and the more things are attached to you. So that's why it's very fortunate when you do get sort of young people becoming monks. And they usually become very, 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 very good monks. And young women becoming nuns, very, very good nuns.
Okay, I understand that to be a nun in Burma, you are called a minchi, not so much as a nun. And being a nun in Burma, you don't really get to practice Dharma because you are serving the monk.
Yeah, that's more like in Thailand. And again, that's upsetting a lot of monks. I mentioned earlier during this retreat that I came back from Thailand with this discussion document about sort of, because of some of the scandals in Thailand about monks, that a lot of the monks, you know, the good monks, the young monks, have, you know, realized that, you know, there's the opportunity to do something. And not just for the monks, for the nuns as well. And part of that document is saying, well, how can we improve both the status of those nuns? It's not just with the nuns, it's with the Thai people, actually, to start respecting these people. It's one of these sort of catch-22 situations. Because the nuns aren't respected, good women don't become nuns. Because good women don't become nuns, the standard of the nuns gets low, and therefore they're not respected. And so, you know, it's a hard thing that you to change that. You need some very sort of strong-minded women to say, I'm going to become a nun, I'm going to make it respectable. So, but the monks want to sort of help out that way, and so do the lay Buddhists in Thailand. And sort of, you know, let's, you know, call them Mechis. I like calling them nuns because nuns and monks in the Western term, so there is an equality there. That's the female monks, these are the male monks. And that's why even Sister Wayama over here, we started talking when she first came here. You know, should we call her like the abbess of the monastery? And I said, that's not a good idea to call it that, because there was we got a letter from England, and the head nun of this small temple in England, instead of being called the abbess, the people started calling her the nickname, the abyss. The abyss of the monastery. because she's obviously quite domineering. And there's now these other titles sometimes you call them Aya, you know, like Aya Cayman, Aya this, and again that got the nickname the Ayatollah. So, very, very careful. So, you know, so we said, well, look, you know, why not call you abbot? So you've got the abbot of the nuns' monastery, abbot of the monks' monastery. Let's use like a gender neutral term. Make it gender neutral. And that makes it much better, I think. So little by little, we get the, whether you're an Asian monk or a Western monk, or whether you're a woman monk or a male monk, whatever monk you are, if you're a gay monk, doesn't matter, as long as you're a monk and not practicing any sexuality, if you're a good monk, then you should be respected. And it's true, that actually happens, that people respect good practitioners. And basically, it doesn't really matter if you're male or female, people won't respect you if you're messing around and not doing the job. So that's coming, it's sensible, and it's been established, so it's wonderful to see that. So it's not the job of the nuns to wash up for the monks. That's the job of the bodhisattvas, are supposed to try and help us become enlightened. Sacrifice our own enlightenment. That's a joke, I should be careful there. Okay, I think that's enough questions for now.